are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Zach Jackson, and the inanimate object that I talk to most would probably be one of the seven plants in my office that all have names and personalities in my head.
Is that cheating? Is that offensive?
They are alive. Okay, so this is Ian Benz, and I guess you could say my car.
Rachel Jackson, and in a vein of cheating, the inanimate object I talk to the most is my Amazon Alexa Echo.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's so good. That feels like cheating, too. Kendra Holtmore, my bicycle, which I often pretend is a horse.
This one is easy for me. This is Bud. Bud is a Bud vase with whom I had all of my department meetings the first year that I was here when I was by myself in my department. We would talk to each other in order to make me feel better about the fact that I was alone in my department.
I wish I could have seen that.
This translates really well to podcast, by the way.
It makes me feel really good. Yeah, nobody can see Bud, but he has a great
cigar. Can
you describe Bud? Yeah, he's a bald, cigar-smoking, blue-eyed track person. I always envisioned him like at the horse track betting constantly. So he was my friend my first year while I was here.
Can we put a picture of Bud in the show notes?
Oh, that feels appropriate. I'll take a picture of Bud and make sure that it gets there to Zach.
That's important.
I think it is.
It is important.
Yeah. That was...
And what's your name, Adam?
Oh, I was so excited about my inanimate object, I completely forgot about me. So my name is Adam Pryor. The inanimate object I talk to is Bud. Bud the Bud vase. Sometimes I keep dead flowers in it. It makes students feel better when they walk in.
Yeah. Okay, so this week we are continuing our conversation about authority and what authority means in the context of religious and scientific communities. Where are points of contact? Where does authority look very different in these communities? And I thought that just to start, it seemed like last week there were some loose threads people had to leave at different times. So I think before offering a formal question or something, I kind of just wanted to see first if there were things that any of you felt that you didn't get to fully share or articulate the way you wanted to, and we can maybe just pick up there. I know there were different conversations happening. I think the story that we kind of ended talking about, but it went in a few different directions, was the Mauna Kea story about the telescope and whether or not that was appropriate to put on Mauna Kea, which was marked as a sacred site. Then that kind of, there was some wormholes, maybe you might say, that
we were talking about Thanos.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Adam
that kind
was
of
trash
got
talking
off.
Thomas Paine and.
Because that was about the fictional universe question. That was like an interlude.
We didn't end up using.
Yeah. And then we started talking about, I think one of you asked, how do we parse the authority of religious and scientific communities? And I wanted to ask a question about utilitarianism. So yeah, there's lots of things we can work with, but I just wanted to see what y'all were thinking, if there was anything you wanted to say to continue from last week.
I feel like Adam was on a really interesting train of thought at the end.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what it was.
That feels so long ago right now.
I think I had mentioned that Thomas Paine quote about how revelation is really only for the individual and all else is hearsay, and religions are based on experience. And then you were questioning
I was kind of whacking at Thomas Paine there for a while.
I know, the poor guy. Well, like, he died friendless and penniless, and here he is.
That's what happens when you uphold the liberal autonomous individual. You die penniless and friendless.
Lesson learned.
I think for me, one of the place that I was getting to at the end of the last episode is this question of partly where authority comes from, who gets to have it, and what it looks like in different communities. Right. So we had all these examples of different communities engaging authority and engaging it and using it in different ways. And that to me is very interesting, I think, particularly because I work with college students. Right. So I see these sort of like small groups evolve in this microcosm of a campus where I see authority pop up in different ways for different groups, and different folks are granted authority in different ways. And to me, that feels very parallel to what we have when we talk about these intersections of religion and science, that different authority, like what's an authority for one group is not an authority in another. And authority gets granted in ways that we don't necessarily always think are great, but it does happen, right? So that was one of the things that I was sort of curious about. And then the other was like, when you have authority with power, right? And this is where I get really angry with Thomas Paine and other sort of like democratic individualists, right? Which is to say, like, there are people who have authority over me that I did not grant them the power that they have. And yet they do have authority over me. And that is a certain sort of authority. So the authority that comes with like ungiven power, right? Power that I didn't give over to someone else. That authority is also interesting to me and seems relevant to science.
Now, let me ask you on that piece then. Because I've really been struggling with that concept specifically, mostly
which concept?
So the concept of authority without being granted the power, right? Okay. So I'm thinking of, and I think I disagree with you, Adam, but maybe I don't fully understand your point. When I'm looking at that as an example, if I ascribe myself to a particular society, as you're bringing up your college students, right? They ascribe themselves to being in that college. They chose that college. And a large choice can then have small choice ramifications. Let me be a little bit more clear. I ascribe myself to Judaism as a general whole. I then narrow my choice in the idea that I am a liberal Jew, right? In this religiously liberal. And without my granting the authority, or excuse me, without my granting the power, the chief rabbi of Israel has so much influence over my life that I did not give him, but I kind of did by ascribing myself to the tribalism of Judaism. And from a scientific standpoint, if I am a scientist, or when I was a scientist practicing, I found myself within that community and had to live then within those laws. And one of the companies, I love sharing. I love collaboration. I believe that if we treat each other with respect, and maybe I just have a naivete that people don't steal ideas. But when I worked for a company, everything was intellectual property and we couldn't say a word about what we were doing. And that really bothered me. Or when I was there, we were constantly asked about the NIH director, who I didn't give that person power or authority, but by putting myself in a scientist role, I did. Does that make sense? And I think that's where I'm disagreeing.
Yeah. So for me, right, those are all, in a certain sense, those are still elective groups, right? I've chosen, for whatever set of reasons, right, in order to be a part of this group, that I lend a piece of my autonomy over, I give power right to some authority in that group, and then it's given, right? So the question for me is like, what do you do then with sort of pure scientific discovery that has practical applications, right? Like, I don't behave that way with regard to the silly example, right, would be like gravity. Whether I choose to ascribe authority to the gravity that will draw me down back to the earth when I leap out of the third floor window doesn't matter, right? Whether I choose to give over power to that or not, it will happen, right? And that to me is the sort of interesting piece about where science sort of gets into this sort of gray territory, right? On the one hand, it seems like there are communities of scientists of which we elect to be a part, like what you were describing with your like position. But then there's also this element to science has this other way of having authority or having power that seems very different from that I elect to be in a group aspect. And that to me, that confusion, I think, is really interesting and also can be problematic.
And to play on the gravity metaphor, pragmatically, yes. If you jump out your third floor window, you will go down whether or not you believe in gravity or have magic pixie dust or anything like that. But scientists, physicists, you know, you put yourself in a camp, you put yourself under the authority of well-tested theories, right? That you put yourself under the authority of the understanding of gravity that comes from general relativity. But if you don't give that theory authority, then your exploration and calculations are going to go off in different directions. You know, if you are a string theorist, then you have a whole different set of assumptions than if you are, you know, if you are a different kind of physicist. And depending on where you have placed your authority in the, depending on which theory you have given authority in your mind, you will end up with different conclusions, if that makes any sense. End result will be the same because the laws are baked in and your belief does not matter in that regard. But the thing that you give authority to, the framework, will then determine where you end up.
And Zach is talking about like the interpretations of the phenomenon, where I hear Adam talking about like the actual phenomenon, the effects of that phenomenon, of gravity. And I think what I've been thinking of this whole time is that authority for me is something that is inherently social. And so I wouldn't describe gravity as having authority over me. I would describe gravity as just like being a law of nature. And the way you can describe that law of nature might be different, but authority is relational in my mind in a way that's distinct from something like gravity.
Yes, in Kurt Vonnegut's book, Galapagos, the whole world society falls apart at the very beginning of the book. And it does so because of financial reasons, because everyone kind of starts to realize that all financial institutions are meaningless and that it's just a bunch of numbers in a computer that a bunch of people have decided mean something. But then everyone realizes kind of at once that, oh, actually, it doesn't mean anything. And you can't eat a computer, and so society falls apart. And I brought this up to an economist friend of mine, and I said, you know, all of this is so ridiculous. All the economic systems are just so ridiculous. They're just even like the gold standard. We pick a metal that's rare but useless for anything practical. It's just rare and shiny, but you can't do anything with it. And he said, well, there's no more human venture out there than economics, because what are we if not the most social of all primates? And what is economics except the most social of all ways of organizing society? That the whole thing only works because of mutual trust, because the majority of people have agreed that this thing will have value, and it is all societal. It's all trust.
So can I ask a question then? Because I kind of like this distinction that like the effects of laws are different than the authority because of this relational piece. That to me makes a lot of sense. So is the power that's affected, right, the power that someone uses in that relational authority versus the power that we would talk about in those effects of laws, is that a different kind of power? Because we've used that term power a lot too. And so I'm curious sort of like what's underpinning that for other people.
If I understand what we're talking about with the distinction here, I would think that the power is different. Because I feel like if we go back to the example of gravity and then what, you know, Kendra said about authority, that I would agree we're not really giving gravity authority. Because to me, I feel like authority, again, goes back to a social construct that I can push back against authority, right? It's, I mean, I feel like I can't really push back against gravity. Gravity's there, period. I could do things to impact the effect of gravity on me, like if I'm falling from an airplane, put on a parachute, but I'm still falling, right? So I lessen the effect of gravity on me because I have something else to help me out. But no, I wouldn't, because gravity is still affecting me. I just now have a different force. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I feel like with gravity, I can't challenge that authority. Whereas an elected official or scientists or, you know, a clergy member, I can challenge the authority.
It kind of goes back to the opening question of speaking to an inanimate object, right? That the inanimate object is there and we give it authority and power and the ability to speak, even though it doesn't. I do want to turn back real quick to something that Adam and Zach, you were saying, which was you were sort of debating, you know, if it's string theory or if you're more Newtonian physics. What if it's just not physics at all? Right. If that's not the authority that you give it, you jump out of the window and you say, God is going to save me. It has nothing to do with gravity, because if I firmly believe in miracles and I firmly believe in an interventionist God, then it has nothing to do with gravity.
Yeah.
Right. So even the concept of where that authority lies within, say, laws of nature or inanimate things, I think going to Kendra's point, it's still a societal picture that we paint for ourselves in the interpretation.
And we bump into this as a society too, when parents don't treat their children for illnesses because they believe that God will save them. And it's a religious conviction. And then the kid dies and they, you know, we want to prosecute the parents for child neglect and homicide in some cases, but they're saying that it's God. And God has the authority over life and death, and not the doctors. And
I mean, there's a recent memoir called Educated by Tara Westover, which highlights that piece, right? That God is going to save and heal all wounds. And from a large standpoint, who are we to argue? So when we have these competing forces of authority, how do we even have the ability to say, right, in that playground tone, my authority is better than your authority?
Right.
Because if I believe that, yes, vaccines are amazing, yes, stitches help, yes, antibiotics really do help cure things or, you know, eliminate the problem within the body, and someone else says, no, God does all those things, where's our place of commonality?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
As a society or relationally or interpersonally?
I think, yeah, all.
Yeah, right? Because I don't want my child being in school with children that are not vaccinated. I don't care if that's your religious belief, that, or your, frankly, uneducated belief, or your fear of big pharma or science or technology or whatever it may be, government conspiracies. I believe in the power of herd immunity because I have seen it and we have data. and I don't want my child potentially being killed by your ignorance. In that case, I think the greater good of people outweighs whatever individual belief they might have in what authority that they have ascribed to.
What if it is not my personal, but my religious body, my religious organization that is saying these things? Right? Even if we take it, you know, take it away from medical, right? Take it away from that realm. We can even talk about it from the realm of, you know, who do you vote for? Is there a separation of church and state? Should there be? How do we define personal autonomy and personal liberties as in society with religious liberties? Right? I mean, not so long ago, and, you know, right now, we're still dealing with the question of LGBTQ. Right? And some people are proclaiming religious issues, and they're upholding their very strong, their very firm faith-based understanding. How is that then different than someone who is doing the same thing on the other side?
So I have a story about this. My denomination, the United Church of Christ, is a congregational denomination, which means that every church has the autonomy to believe and do what they feel fit. The national church has no power whatsoever to dictate to individual churches what to believe, what to say, what to do. None of that. We come from the pilgrims, and we really, really cherish individual autonomy. To that end, every other year we get together at the General Synod and we make these big sweeping resolutions about different social issues or internal issues or whatnot. We have these resolutions of witness in which we make statements that we have no power to do anything about, right? We made a statement a couple of years ago calling on the U.S. government to work to clean up space junk, which is a huge issue, and I'm glad we talked about it, but what authority do we have in that? We, as a denomination, became an open and affirming denomination of LGBTQ people 15 years ago or so, because historically we have been. We ordained the first gay minister in like 1972. But that didn't mean anything to local churches. We had no authority to tell local churches they had to then become open and affirming. So at the national setting, we've got all this pride and liberation and open inclusivity. Locally, we have no power to do so. So there's a group that within the UCC who believes that we've strayed too far left and wants to bring us back to the right. And they have a booth in the exhibition hall. And they are handing out literature talking about how being LGBTQ is, you know, against the Bible. And, you know, that's a part of their message, not their whole message. So some people fought back and other people came and they made a resolution calling for guidelines to be met before you could have a space in the exhibition hall, because they didn't want them to be there because their beliefs went in contradiction to the stated stances that the greater church had made in the past. And then the argument was, who made those decisions except a non-binding body? So who were you to then take away our rights to dissent with the over... Yeah, those people who voted during that. And we had this really messy conversation about how we can have autonomy of individuals and of churches, but also have a joint set of values that we can all agree to. And we didn't have the conversation. They tabled it for the next time, which is just, it's just so UCC to not have that conflict. And all of my UCC brethren and sistren and friends out there, you know what I'm talking about. We are wonderfully ridiculous. But that conversation is so important and we're not having it. And yeah, so you know, the Lutherans, just they had their conference and they voted to be a sanctuary denomination. and they have authority built into their system where they can then make certain proclamations that happen on the ground instead of just a strongly worded letter like we have, because we don't have authority built into the top. We have it built into the individual.
I think you imagine Lutherans have more authority built into their system than they probably actually do. But I will say I'm pretty glad that it's, you know, like the first time we beat the UCC on like some sort of liberal issue, like ever.
Mazel tov.
I'll tell you, the UCC is free to beat everyone at every liberal issue, because when they do, they don't have to back it up with anything. We can make these big issues about immigration and
space junk,
human rights and space junk and the reunification of the Korean Peninsula. But it
I like
this
space junk one.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. You can say anything you want if you don't have to back it up with action.
No, I was thinking, though, that part of what we're talking about, and maybe to go back for a second to the question that Rachel asked, which is, like, what's the difference between the way these communities, like, make the kinds of decisions that people abide by? I think something that we maybe talked about in the last episode, but there's something really important about the relationship between power and truth. Or we could talk about authority and truth, but I think to talk about authority and the kind of power that's in authority as something social, you have to talk about truth, which for a lot of thinkers would also be a social concept, and not for everyone. But in this case, I think it's useful because someone like Michel Foucault, who was a French philosopher in the 20th century, he talks about truth and power as being inextricably linked, and that truth is something that happens when people take knowledge and they make truth out of the knowledge that's created in that society, and that has this power to like divide between what is right and wrong, moral, immoral, true, false. But like you have to decide like how that's going to happen. And then over time, it becomes this implicit power that you just take for granted because that's the way that the world works. And it's very controversial to question like what is like ultimately true or false. And so that this is like a social construction way of talking about these concepts. But I think it does relate to a lot of the things that we've been talking about today and even the last episode where we talked about consensus and scientific truth or like religious truth being something that the community needs consensus upon. I think it relates to that conversation. So I don't know. I feel kind of stuck on this question of like, not just the one that Rachel asked, but also Adam's question about like, how do we talk about different kinds of power in the social way we're discussing, but also in with regards to gravity. What's the power of gravity and how do you talk about that differently? But I think that's one of the ways I would distinguish between these kinds of power, because power I think of as being something that's very big and abstract and it takes many forms, but it's just something that it exists and circulates through communities, and people don't always have power. Like you may have it for a little while and then you lose it. But yeah, I think that would be one way I think makes sense to talk about it in the social sense, as being something that's intimately connected to the formation of truth through the knowledge that we create through scientific processes or through religious interpretations and rituals and beliefs and things of that nature.
It seems that there's a power that is given out of fear, right? So the power that police officers have, if you don't do what they say, they have the ability to make your life miserable, right? That they can do physically something to you. And then there's the power that's given by people to someone that they respect. You know, the Dalai Lama has no actual power to make anyone's life miserable, but has all kinds of power in what he says and does in the world. You know, these people who have influence because we've decided that they should, and not because that they are forcing it.
So I wonder, Kendra, because I really, anytime Foucault comes up, I'm sort of on board and thinking about that. But I'll also, like, right, so a big part of that way that you're framing power to me seems like repetition is really, really critical. And I'm wondering if you would say maybe more about that, or if I'm putting words
what
in your
you
mouth,
mean?
You don't have to. Right. So like part of the power that comes like from a sort of social description of authority that way, right, is that repetition solidifies into particular sorts of identities that then carry authority. Right. So the power comes from the concretization, the repetition of a particular identity that then allows it to be seen as normative, whether it was or wasn't. Right. So this is sort of like a sort of typical move in queer theory, from my understanding. Right. You have a definition of what constitutes the normal, right, that's based on a series of repetitions that only can be viewed by scapegoating sort of a set of outsiders.
Mm.
Right. Who are outside of the norm, which is what reveals what the norm is. So you have this, right? This is, you know, it's sort of like variations on Hegel, right? This is sort of what's going on. And there's a certain sense to which that's also going on in those descriptions of scientific power, right? Like, why does gravity have authority? Because every time you jump out of the window, you fall, right? There's a repetition there that allows it to sort of carry that authority. And so I'm wondering if part of what's going on when we talk about power, whether we're talking about it as those like laws, natural laws, or whether we're talking about it in terms of the authority that's granted, right, is part of what we're talking about the way in which we ascribe to the power of these repetitions, these predictable actions that come.
I think I would say yes. If I'm understanding you correctly, Adam, the repetition happens through these like institutions that are set up to create knowledge. So thinking of like universities that pour money into research projects where they publish journals that validate the results of a study that happened 10 years ago. And the repetition of the results confirms that it's probably true. So like, here's an interpretation of those results, and that is going to count as scientific knowledge. And then we use that knowledge to say something about what is true of the world, and that like feeds into our notions of maybe what is like moral or immoral. Like, is this the kind of process that you are imagining?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that makes sense, and I don't think that that's a satisfactory picture of like what truth can mean ultimately for a lot of people, because I think on the other hand we sometimes like to think about truth, maybe like capital T truth, as being something that's more transcendent and outside of time, and I too find that like a really appealing notion, but I think the social constructionist way of looking at truth is it just feels more practical to me, even if it's not like the idealistic abstract transcendent version of truth. It's appealing to me because it makes sense of the community that I live in.
I think it was George Orwell in 1984 said, "He who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past." That the stories you tell about where we've been help you to create a story that will move people into a future that you want to see. Like, for example, what does Santa Claus look like? He's a big, jolly guy.
I think this is a
right?
good opportunity for listener participation, where we should get images of Santa Clauses from people who are listening to this.
Actually, that's a great idea.
Yeah,
that would be another inanimate object to talk to.
But what you think of as Santa Claus right? The traditional image of Santa Claus and the red outfit and the big jolly guy with the white beard and all of that we imagine it must be hundreds of years old, going way back.
Shaking like a bowl full of jelly.
Right. It's from 1930 from a Coca-Cola ad.
Mm-hmm.
But it got plastered all over everywhere and it just became the thing. And people assume it's much older than it is. But that's how truth works sometimes.
Yeah. I think there's a difference that I'm hearing. And Kendra, you said capital T truth. We have to differentiate truth, either with mm-hmm. a capital T or a lower T, from fact, true, false. I think there's a difference between true and truth. And true, false is provable up until a certain point, right? For me, true, false is the scientific realm. And truth, again, big or little T, is the society. And, you know, so that can be capital T truth because religion and God holds the ultimate truth and we're trying to discover it through whatever scripture or whatever rituals that we're doing. But that's different than the true falseness of gravity, right? Where we can say, yes, gravity exists in this way. Believe it or not believe it, it doesn't really matter. And then going to the true falseness of Santa Claus picture, not the concept, we can say, okay, we have a false statement that this is hundreds of years old and we can believe that. But the truth is that our society has ascribed the red-suited, jolly, white-bearded, elderly man for hundreds of years, and therefore it must be true. Right. So we really have to parse out what those words are when we're looking at this. And part of our challenge as society is to make that differentiation of saying, this is my truth. And it almost doesn't matter if it is true.
Okay. So just because y'all all be wrong, having grown up in South Louisiana, Santa Claus is a skinny dude with a huge beard pulled by 8 alligators in a Piro.
What?
Just
alligators?
Shows up in all kinds of people's yards.
Are you talking about the one from the, there's a book that was published out of Louisiana?
Uh-huh.
And uh-huh. He didn't
Clovis
eat
the crawfish.
He rode alligators.
He rode alligators.
Instead of reindeer.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying.
Yeah, I was about to say, this is like the Florida version of Santa Claus, maybe.
Yeah, so this is
reindeer, by the way, really love hallucinogenic mushrooms that grow under the snow. And if humans eat them, then they get the sensation of flying. That's where that myth comes from, by the way.
Yep. And
okay,
reindeer.
A special Christmas episode.
Yeah, just full of so
and
many.
And where do you find
tidbits.
These mushrooms? I'm just right, acting for a friend.
Somewhere up in the Arctic Circle, I would imagine.
So are we going to go on a field trip?
You know,
time to start
there
selling
is,
t-shirts, everybody.
There's a reindeer farm or haven, I think more haven, in Alaska. And the reindeer there are actually very nice and you can feed them and pet them and just wander around with them. And I didn't see any with red noses, but it was summertime. So maybe none of them had a cold, but they're also much larger in person than you imagine. They're also very bulky, unlike moose, right? Moose are not very bulky.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I forget that reindeer are real creatures.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Because they're added to this beautiful myth, right?
Yeah.
This beautiful myth story. So how could they possibly still be true?
Yeah. See, here's my thing. This is what's bugging me about this, Rachel, is that okay, so my Santa Claus, my infinitely superior Santa Claus with its alligators is clearly my truth, right? And your truth right, has your hallucinogenic mushroom reindeers. What I'm saying, right, is that in this conflict, it doesn't really matter, right? But when there is an actual substantive difference between those pieces, right? And there is a also competing in here true-false dichotomy, right? This mm-hmm. is where we get into to really sticky territory. And I don't want to mm-hmm. cede that territory to say, like, it's okay for your truth to be this and my truth to be that. And there's this true-false piece in between that, you know, maybe actually does ascribe to one side or the other of that debate, but we're going to ignore it. And that's when I get really, really nervous.
I think we can give each other the benefit and the recognition that we're complex. And if we make our statement saying, this is my truth and my understanding. Now, I'm particularly thinking about biblical criticism or the events listed in the Bible. Some people believe that I'm going to ignore all of Genesis 1 and 2, right? We're just going to move past the creation story. But look at the Exodus story, right? Some people firmly 100% believe a factual understanding of 600,000 men over the age of 20 left, and their whole families left Egypt, which would then equate to in the neighborhood of 2.5 million people. And that is a factual understanding. And other people say that's a really large number. There is no archaeological evidence. There's no hieroglyphic evidence. There's minimal scientific understanding to back that up. But it's my truth because it's part of my culture to say, remember what it felt like to be a slave and think of God as a redemptive God. And that's truth, whether or not the story of the Exodus was true, and that we can hold that complexity together.
And that's probably okay until you hit like a social issue, right?
Yes, exactly. So like, who killed Jesus, right?
Well, that it depends question, who you ask.
Exactly. So, I mean, if you read the gospel accounts, who killed Jesus?
Which
were,
one?
Well, all of them kind of agree that Jesus was killed by people in power. Jesus threatened the empire and was crucified as an insurrectionist. He was killed by the state. But
Jews have never been in power, by the way.
Somebody like Martin Luther, who was already anti-Semitic, and comes along and the sort of anti-Semitic rants that he goes on about how the Jews were responsible for killing Jesus, you know, fomented this hate in Germany and in that area. I mean, that is not just an innocuous disagreement about biblical criticism. That has real world applications. And at some point, you just have to say, this is not true and it is not helpful and it is dangerous. And especially in our days today, I feel like all of the misinformation and fake news and all of that I am all on board with a plural understanding of truth, you know, your truth and my truth and our truth and all the truth out there, and that facts and fiction are different than truth and other truth and all of that, that there are many paths to truth. But at some point, I have to say that not all paths are equal. Not all truths are fact or true or helpful or good, that there are some that are just evil and wrong and destructive and will tear apart the fabric of our society and that hurt people. And I am not okay with those. I'm mm-hmm. not okay with white nationalism, with hatred, with anti-LGBTQ hatred that leads to violence. I'm not okay with religious extremism that takes people's lives into their own hands. Like, that truth is not okay. And there just has to be a line at somewhere in there.
I prefer to say that there's one truth, and that it's my truth. So the rest of you are wrong.
Well, I'm a white Christian male, so I think mine kind of
works. Oh!
You poor persecuted person, you.
I'm not going to go there. Adam, so, it's probably a good idea that you and I stay quiet right now.
Man, it's not just the botanists who are going to come after Zach.
While I ideologically agree with you completely, 100%, wholeheartedly, and my people have been a target of those issues for, oh, I don't know, 3,000 years, give or take. I think this goes all the way back to our conversation of, well, who are you to say that? What authority do you have to say? And again, please hear me. Hate is wrong.
Yep.
But what authority do you have to say that my wrong belief is wrong? Right? Or a person's, I don't want to say, I can't even say that about myself, right? That a person's hatred is wrong. What authority, what power do you have? Because the person they're listening to, whoever that person might be, is telling them that it is correct, that is the right way of doing it, and everybody else is wrong. And so do we apply a mathematical perfect bell curve and say, okay, once we find the normative, we're allowed to go three standard deviations from there, and anyone outside those three standard deviations is therefore wrong? But then what happens when that standard deviation starts to creep in? And I'm particularly thinking about Nazi Germany, right? Mm-hmm. It was wrong in the 20s and totally okay in the 40s. So at what point do we see that shift?
And I think it's society.
But when society itself is wrong.
I know that.
By the time they get to that point, it's too late.
Right, so we have to stop it before it gets to that point. But how do we impart, sorry, this is kind of my soapbox, how do we impart that we don't want to get to that point? How do we say we have been there? And this kind of goes back to the George Orwell question. He who controls, and it is a he who controls the present controls the past and therefore controls the future. And if we say we don't want to emulate the past, but we need to stop where we are in the present, but they're not talking. Their authority is different.
Well, I think...
And it makes me very sad and impassioned.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I think if you get into the discussion, if you've noticed, there's been a major increase, and I think it's been there for a while, about the discussion of the past, about, for example... You know, we go through ebbs and flows when we get into discussions about the Confederate battle flag and about why the Civil War was fought. And so you have individuals who now have a platform who I think there have been individuals saying for a long time that slavery had nothing to do with it. Now that they have a platform, they're able to get their message out better. So then you have people who proclaim to be historians or experts in those fields who are now then given a platform. And once they're able to, again, get more attention. So that all right there is a societal move. And so that's why it's important for those who do have an accurate understanding of why the Civil War was started, what happened with Nazi Germany, those types of things. You know, all of these atrocities that have occurred throughout history, it is up to... And this, you know, we have given, I'd say society has given people who have the training in those fields the authority to be able to help us better understand. It's then, in my opinion, it's up to those individuals who have been given and also earned that authority to speak up. Because if they don't speak up, we then continue to make the same mistakes that have been made in the past.
I also think that it's maybe a more pessimistic view coming from me, someone who really thrives in optimism. But I think that there's just part of, like, your concerns, Rachel, I think are completely valid. But I think the way I see it is that we just get it wrong. Like, we want to be thinking that we're always progressing towards this, like, capital T truth. But I think that it's just the risk of, like, living in a society and making decisions about what we see as being good or bad, true or false. And I think that you just have to accept that society sometime will be, like, very wrong. And it's not always clear whether we're moving forwards or backwards. And I feel like that is a very depressing thing to say. But I think deep down that's how I feel like the world works.
I I think I would sadly, again, as a person who likes to also live in a realistic optimism perspective, how I navigate those waters is that I may not have faith in humanity, but I have faith in each individual human. And that's how I then navigate my circle and my life.
Have you all seen these deepfake videos?
Deepfake?
I've read about them and they are terrifying.
You should Google this.
Should we?
They're able to take...
Not if you like to live in optimism.
Right? They're able to take videos of people talking and replace their face with another person. Almost imperceptibly so. And then using another system, Radiolab did a really good episode on this, using another program that is freely available, you're able to take 45 minutes of a person talking and then create a voice model based on that. So you can make a video right now using consumer grade technology of, say, Donald Trump declaring nuclear war. That looks convincing.
Don't say that.
And that sounds convincing. And that will make it, you know, for days out in the world before it's able to be corrected. So my optimism about the world getting better at telling truth has kind of diminished over the past couple of years. I'm a little bit more terrified at how easy it is to spread misinformation and how easy it is for otherwise thoughtful people to digest lies and think that they're digesting truth.
Mm-hmm. I just want to lighten it up a little bit and kind of tie into what we talked about last time, going back to the MCU, the Marvel Universe, right? Spoiler, but not really, because it's been out for a long time. Spider-Man Far From Home. That's kind of what that whole movie is talking about, is that we're so susceptible and vulnerable and wanting to believe that we are willing to see fake, that we're willing to see it as real. And it takes a person, and I believe it is a person, right? It's just some teenage boy to see past it and say, no, I refuse to wear that mask, as he's wearing a mask. Also, great movie. So sad about
Tom
Holland. To lighten
things up, I will post in the show notes a deep fake video that replaces all of the characters in the intro to Full House with Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec.
Okay,
and
I like amazing. That.
Okay, it's amazing seeing Mary-Kate
and Ashley
Olsen.
I feel better about this technology.
Yeah.
Right?
It's only because it's fake.
This is true for all internet and all technology. There are sometimes when it is wonderful and amazing and it brings us all together, and sometimes where it could, you know, tear apart the fabric of the universe. Yeah, one way or
cat
the other.
Cat videos.
Who knows?
Yes, I was thinking the same thing. Cat videos are the way to go.
So I'm thinking back to this sort of bit that we were going back and forth about, right? Like in terms of where this falls, in terms of authority, in terms of power, how it is that this is being negotiated. That we have some optimists and we have some pessimists in our group, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to ask a question and then I have to take off because, you know.
Oh, well, how convenient.
My job. Yep, exactly. This is what I like to do. So what I'm curious about is in the midst of these tensions about where we grant authority and how, what is the authority that we want to grant to our religious tradition? And what's the authority we want to grant to science? As those two often are sort of portrayed as competing authorities, but I think for all of us, they're not. We've each sort of negotiated that in different ways, but I would be really curious to hear what sort of authority we're granting to each of those areas, given the ways we've sort of unpacked the difference between power and authority so far. Does that make sense?
Do you want to answer the question first?
No, I don't want to answer the question. I wanted to ask you the question and then leave so that I did not have to answer the question I set forward.
This kind of plays into where I was hoping to go with next week.
Oh, good. Sorry. Don't answer it. Just think about it.
No, because we wanted to talk about issues of trust and the public decay of trust, the decay of trust in religious institutions and also in scientific institutions among religious people. And trust, as we've been talking about, plays a major role in society granting authority to something.
Yeah.
And competing authorities rely a lot on trust. And so if our trust is decaying, why? And what is that going to do in the future?
Well, and I've gotten into, first of all, I'm hopeful that that conversation may occur over 2 weeks, because I think it's a very valuable conversation about trust. But anyway, I definitely, over the past several years, with the influx of the phrasing of fake news, you know, alternative facts, those types of things, that I do get more troubled by, you know, at times thinking to myself that when you think of news sources, that sometimes it's hard to know what should I believe? Like, what is actually right? What is true? When I'm hearing, when I'm reading a news story or listening to something on the radio, and you know, but I do struggle a lot with that, because again, you know, it's a very important part of our society. It helps us make decisions. And so if the thing doesn't, you know, if the news story you're reading doesn't align with what it is that you believe, as, you know, based on how you align on your values, then you're going to dismiss it. Right. And not everyone, I'd say, you know, a minority of people have the time to explore the sources identified in news stories, or to read about a particular topic from multiple news organizations, just because we just don't have the time for it.
We trust that which we trust, and we don't question why we trust it, but just that we trust it. You have your news source that if you read it there, you know that, okay, this is probably trustworthy. But if you read it somewhere else, you know, it's probably not, and you have to go check your place.
Yeah. And it's a scary thing at times, because it's, you know, again, yeah, it's undermining the fabric of our society when you come to a point where you realize, I don't know if I can trust anything I'm reading. And I don't think I'm there, but there are some about particular stories. Sometimes when I read things, I'm like, I just don't know what I can trust.
Right, I think this
what
is,
authority this is going can I media. Trust?
Right. I think that's going into next week's conversation, as we've looked at that. Once we have an authority, where is the trust?
Mm-hmm.
And is my trust different than your trust? Which, of course, it is.
This has been episode 6 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing this podcast with your friends. We just hit 1,000 total downloads, and we couldn't have done any of that without you. So check us out at downthewormhole.com for show notes, amazing deepfake videos, and links to all our social media accounts. Join us next week as we talk about the decline in trust in religious and scientific institutions, and whatever happened to Chi-Chi's restaurant and their fried ice cream.
That's what happens when you uphold the liberal autonomous individual. You die penniless and friendless.